I would like to tell you a little bit about tonight's speaker, Mr. John Keel. Mr. Keel writes for approximately 150 newspapers in this country and all over the world, which deal exclusively with the problem of UFOs for the North American Newspaper Alliance, that's NASA. He's traveled over 10,000 miles in 1966 alone. He personally has investigated scores of UFO incidents, and he has interviewed scores of witnesses. He has also made trips to Washington, D.C. to visit NASA headquarters, and he's talked to many officials in the Pentagon about flying saucers. Currently, he is a board member of the Ivan T. Sanderson Foundation. He is collaborating with that organization on an extensive scientific analysis of the UFO reports of 1966. This analysis will be published and circulated on a limited basis later this year. He is also under contract to Putnam Books to produce a book on UFOs for publication in early 1968. This is the same publisher which issued Incident at Exeter by John G. Fuller, which was a bestseller, as you know. They have also published books by Major Donald Kehoe. Mr. Keel's articles, which he has written in the last year or so on the subject of UFOs, have appeared in True Magazine, in Saga Magazine, and in the Flying Saucer Review in London, which is one of the finest UFO magazines in the world, if not the finest. And it's also appeared in Saucer News and various other publications in the flying saucer field. Recently, he prepared the definitive article on UFOs in collaboration with Dr. J. Allen Hynek for Playboy magazine. Now, Dr. Hynek, as you probably know, is the chief Air Force scientific investigator on the flying saucer subject. This article will appear in the late spring of this year or early summer. Mr. Keel, I would say, at the present time, has done more recently, surely, for the UFO subject than any other writer or lecturer that I know of. And it gives me, personally, a great deal of pride and satisfaction to bring him now to our microphones. Mr. John Keel.
Jim forgot one question earlier. He should have asked how many of you are from the FBI, because I have here the full text of the CIA report of the Robertson panel in 1953. This text, as you know, has been censored and butchered for many years, and I want to read a couple of passages from this, give you an idea of the caliber of men we have working in the United States government and the CIA, the FBI, and so on. Under the section called Unofficial Investigating Groups, they say this. The panel took cognizance, I'm going to have like with sheep herders here. The panel took cognizance of the existence of such groups as the Civilian Flying Saucer Investigators in Los Angeles and the Aerial Phenomena Research Organization, which was then in Wisconsin. This was 1953. It was believed that such organizations should be watched because of their potentially great influence on mass thinking if widespread sightings should occur. The apparent irresponsibility and possible use of such groups for subversive purposes should be kept in mind. Now, what this means when it comes from someone like the CIA and ends up in a report which turns up on the desks of many high officials, it means that it really gives the FBI and the CIA carte blanche to investigate these groups. And as many of you know, they've done this over the years. They've harassed UFO investigators, amateur UFO investigators, civilians. They've harassed people who've taken photographs of these things. And they've done it all because of this couple of sentences. A number of things in here which are rather appalling. There was a member of this panel named Dewey Fournay. He's not named in here, but this is the man involved, who spent several months preparing an airtight case, he thought, to prove the flying saucers came from outer space. He prepared an extensive document on this, and he presented it before this panel. Now, I haven't seen the document, but I know a great deal about it, and I know that he did a very thorough job. Now, here's what they say about Dewey Fournay's report. One of the panel members in his presentation showed how he had eliminated each of the known and probable causes of sightings, leaving him extraterrestrial as the only one remaining in many cases. His background as an aeronautical engineer and technical intelligence officer could not be slighted. However, the panel could not accept the cases cited by him because they were raw, unevaluated reports. I don't know how you would define an evaluated report. I suppose it's when they decide it's a weather balloon or swamp gas. On the next page, on page 6, we have the story of the famous Fremont in Utah film. They shot a movie film back in the early 50s, 1,600 frames of a formation of flying saucers, in color yet. The intelligence command of the Air Force took this film and microscopically analyzed it. Here's what they say about it. The panel received a briefing by representatives of the U.S. Navy Photo Interpretation Laboratory on their analysis of the film. This team had expended, at Air Force request, approximately 1,000 hours of professional and sub-professional time in the preparation of graph plots of the individual frames of the film, showing apparent and relative motion of the objects and variation in their light intensity. It was the opinion of the PIL representatives that the objects sighted were not birds, balloons, or aircraft, were not reflections because there was no blinking while passing through 60 degree of arc, and were therefore self-luminous. Plots of motion and variation in light intensity of the objects were displayed. While the panel members were impressed by the evident enthusiasm, industry, and the extent of effort of the PIL team, they would not accept the conclusions reached. Now, here these people had worked 1,000 hours, it says here, preparing all kinds of graphs and charts and everything to prove their case, and the panel just threw it out. They do this page after page. I get so mad when I read this that I'm just appalled that any government official reading this kind of report could accept it. It seems to me that any responsible general or a politician on reading something like this would demand further explanation. And then there are all kinds of nonsense thrown in. They happen to mention in here thousands of reports received through channels each year, and then it says in parentheses, 1900 and 1952. Well, in all of the Air Force data sheets that they put out every year, they say there were 1,500, but here it says 1,900. So they don't even get their statistics right. I could talk all night about that. As I mentioned last night on Long John's show, I've been going over with a fine-tooth comb, I've been going over all the reports of 1966, and I've been dealing primarily with what we call the Type 1 reports. Of course, there are all kinds of reports. The Type 1 report is either a landing or a very low-level sighting in which the witness is considered to be a very good witness, a police officer, or a person of responsibility in his community, and is not a drunk or a hoaxer. And these, I selected 730 of these Type 1 reports and ran an analysis on them. And as I told Long John last night, we've broken some of it down statistically. We're still doing it. We found that 20% of all the sightings occurred on a Wednesday. We had the most sightings on a Wednesday, and if you want to really see a flying saucer, your best chance to see one is at 10 o'clock on Wednesday night. Now, I don't know why that is. It seems to me that if we were dealing with a psychological phenomenon, this would be spread out evenly across the week. It seems that there would be more people out on a Saturday night, and therefore your chances of seeing these things would be much greater. That is, we'd get more reports on a Saturday night, but that isn't true. Wednesday night, when everyone should be home watching television, they're out seeing flying saucers. Now, I'll give you an example of what we call flaps. Now, these things are sighted all across the country on these flap dates. Sometimes you'll go for 2 or 3 days with no sightings at all, or just 1 or 2 random sightings. Then, for example, on Wednesday, March 30th and 31st, there were 160 sightings in every state in the country. There was a very near landing out on Long Island that night. Before I forget it, there was a landing last week in Long Island, out near East Hampton. It hasn't been reported to the press. I got a call tonight. The police out there, instead of calling the Air Force, now they call me. Because I go out there, and I've been cooperating with them, and I've set this up around the country. And I get calls from all over the country now from people who are fed up with the Air Force and they don't know who to turn to, so they turn to that nut with a beard that passed through last month. And I get some very weird stories from mayors and police officers. And that's why I'm going back to West Virginia, because the civil defense director down there has been very upset about some things that have been happening. I'm going back down and play hero and solve the whole thing. Probably I'll be taken aboard a flying saucer and flown to Venus. And when I get back, nobody will believe me, and that'll be the end of my career. I mentioned that on August 16th, we had a flap on a Tuesday, which was the only real big flap on a Tuesday all year long. The rest of the year, Tuesday gave us only 7% of our sightings. But on August 16th, there was a flap in five states, including New Jersey. We had sightings in New Jersey that night of people seeing these things coming down over power lines. Out in Michigan and in Minnesota, there were sightings from one end of the state to the other. There was a landing at the Flying Cloud Airport outside of Minneapolis. And pilots and police officers at the airport saw this thing come down on the runway, and they all started for it on foot, and the thing took off again. In Arkansas, the flap was so great over the major cities in Arkansas that the local news commentators took their microphones out into the street and did a live broadcast. But that's nothing. In 65, during a flap in Mexico, they wheeled television cameras out into the street of Mexico City and did a live broadcast. While here in New York City, we don't really hear much about flying saucers or see much of them, you find that throughout the country, people believe in them because they see them all the time. There are some areas where now they're so commonplace, people don't report them anymore. That area in West Virginia, for example. On Wednesday, November 2nd, a man named Woodrow Durenberger claimed that he came upon a flying saucer on a highway and that a being got out and spoke to him. And you may have seen it was in the Look magazine issue on flying saucers. And I'm going to be spending some time with Mr. Durenberger, I think, when I go down there. 4 days later, and about 30 miles away, an elderly man, a 70-year-old man, in a very small town called Fuller's Falls, was out taking a walk. And he saw a large object on a tripod arrangement, and it scared the living daylights out of him. And he turned around and started to leave the scene. And he claims that he heard a voice saying, "Don't run, don't run." He said he didn't run, but he walked pretty fast. We have several thousand cases of people seeing the creatures that get out of these things, or seeing people around these things. A lot of people think in terms of contactees, people who talk to the flying saucer beings and get a message for the good of mankind. But we have many people who just simply report that they've seen the creatures, that the creatures jumped into the craft and flew off, and that's all. And we call them contactors, and they're all over the country. Everywhere I go, people tell me these stories. When I was traveling through Virginia and West Virginia and Ohio, I'd be sitting in a restaurant having coffee, and I'm rather conspicuous, and in a small town, everyone knows a stranger anyway. And farmers and people would come up to me very shyly, and they'd ask me if I was the fellow who was searching for flying saucers. And then they'd sit down and they'd say, "Something happened to me last week or last month. I've been afraid to tell anybody about it, but maybe you know something about this and you can help us." And then they'd tell me the wildest damn stories, wilder than anything in the literature. For example, cattle stealing. I've heard these stories in every state, that the farmers see these things come down in their fields and take away a cow or two. Now, you're all familiar probably with the classic story of 1896, where a farmer named Alexander Hamilton signed an affidavit that this happened to him. Since then, we've had such cases in France and in California, and now we're having it, apparently, an epidemic of it, but most of these people are not coming forward with these stories because they don't know who to tell. And when I'm in the area, they usually tell me, or some of them do anyway. But this is a real part of the problem is that the American public isn't telling the Air Force the truth about flying saucers. And this is something that I've been feeding the Air Force some of the information I collect so that later when they can't say, "We didn't know about that," because then I can whip out my file and say, "Well, I sent it to you on such and such a date." I've been in communities where the people were afraid to go out at night because so many strange things were happening. I've met and talked with many people who are now afraid to drive alone at night, men and women both, because of the strange things that have been happening. There are quite a few alleged kidnapping attempts, which I'm still investigating and building quite a file on, and have upset whole communities. And the Air Force claims they don't know anything about these. And as near as I can determine, there have been no government investigators in these areas. It's all happening very quietly, almost underground. And the local police generally are rather, you know, they don't like anything to upset the routine, and they don't take these things seriously until the roof falls in on them. And in a few communities, it has. Now, going back to the business of contactors, on December 3rd, 1966, a California Highway Patrol officer named Vern Morris, with his wife and a few other people, saw what they described as a flying water heater. It was a cylinder, and it was hovering just above the ground, and there was a man in it. Now, he said that they could see the man's head in it, and that he was wearing a silver crash helmet. And they watched this object for several minutes as it maneuvered over a field and then shot away. It was a glowing object. It was surrounded by the usual luminous glow. Now, Vern Morris has gone on record, and these are some of the newspaper clippings. Here's his picture, drawings of the object. He's taken a big chance with his reputation to go on record with his story. And he's only one of the hundreds that are coming forward with these stories. Strange story. What could this thing be with a man in it, a hot water heater with a man in it? Yet it must have happened, or this man wouldn't have gone out on the limb that he did. Now, last night, we started off the Long John show with my discussion of the Mothman, which probably many of you had never heard of this case. Although this case was carried on the wire services, it was widely published in every state in the country. The New York newspapers never mentioned it, to my knowledge, but it was published in newspapers everywhere else. And there have been constant sightings of this creature down there. And I want to point out something that I never did get a chance to say on the Long John show. The area where this creature is being seen is a World War II ammunition dump, which is still filled with high explosives, 2,500 acres of it. These high explosives are kept in concrete igloos, which are camouflaged, so they can't be seen from the air. I'm going to show you a short strip of film that I took down there. Again, it's a very dull film because it's just the area where these sightings have taken place. In this film, you will see the power plant, the abandoned power plant, which was used, there was an arsenal there during the Second World War, and this power plant was used for that arsenal. And the first sighting of the creature took place around that power plant, and there have been other sightings since around that power plant. I had some very strange experiences there. On December 11th, 1966, Mr. Chester LaPorte and a Steve Pearson Jr. saw the Mothman in this area over one of these concrete igloos and watched fly away. And at that very moment, I was about half a mile away in another section looking for the damn thing. So that was my luck. I never saw the Mothman, but other people did while I was there. The Mothman has pursued automobiles on a number of occasions and has reached speeds up to 100 miles an hour, scaring the daylights out of the drivers. There is only one bird that can go anywhere near that fast. It's a certain eagle, and it can reach 70 or 80 miles in a steep dive straight down if it's diving at some prey on the ground. But we don't know of any bird that could do this. And if this thing is a bird, it's the weirdest bird we're still... when Mothman first appeared, a number of distinguished scientists, hundreds of miles away, decided that it was the sandhill crane. So I got some pictures of a sandhill crane, which is a large bird, stands about this high, has a very long neck. I took this picture around to all the witnesses of Mothman and showed it to them, and they said it wasn't a bird. It wasn't the sandhill crane. And then in January, somebody shot a large owl down there. And so they decided, oh, we've solved the mystery. It's an owl. And the owl, of course, stood about this high. It was a pretty big owl. But again, the witnesses went around and looked at the owl, and they said, no, that's not the Mothman. The Mothman is from 6 to 7 feet tall. He has two large red eyes, 2 inches in diameter. Now, all of the witnesses say the same thing. He has a wingspread of 10 feet. And here's another little irony. An object this size needs very large wings to support it. A human being, you or I, if we were going to make a glider that we could strap on ourselves and fly with, that we would need a wingspan of about 35 feet. Now, Mothman is bigger than we are, and he's got a 10-foot wingspan, and he flies anyway, like the bumblebee. Some of the witnesses down there now say that they have heard the sound of some kind of motor, humming sound, as the object passes over their head. So possibly this thing is propelled by something. The wings do not move when it's in flight. When this creature is standing on the ground, his wings are folded back. And then when he takes off, the wings spread. As I said last night, no one has seen any arms on this thing. The wings spread, the thing takes off straight up. Now, most large birds need a running start. If you've ever watched any kind of large bird, whether it's a seagull or even very often pigeons, they take a few steps before they take off. They have to sort of build up speed, ground speed. And this thing doesn't do that. It just goes straight up in the air and then goes straight across and pursues whatever it's pursuing, people or automobile or flying to its flying saucer to go away.
What?
Yes?
That is an angel from heaven.
Well, I don't know if an angel. I don't know if an angel would be that ugly. Well, we've got a pretty ugly angel down there. Yeah. Well, Mothman is a term that the newspapers have tagged onto this thing. This is a newspaper term. Anyway, I want to show you this movie of the arsenal area and the power plant. You'll also see two of the young men who have seen this creature, and they just sort of point out where they saw it. But otherwise, it's not a very dramatic film. And at the very end of the film, you'll see one of these concrete igloos, which has grass growing over it, and it's rather camouflaged. This is the one particular igloo that Mr. Laporte and Pearson saw the creature flying over. Now we have over 100 reports of Mothman, and more coming in every week. So there's not really much reason to doubt that he exists. He sounds unlikely, but there is something like this down there, and I'm sure anxious to find out what it is. It's Point Pleasant, West Virginia. It's about 50 miles from where Woodrow Dernberger had his contact. As I said, it's 2,500 acres. There are hundreds of these igloos there. There are 4 families living within this area, so it's very thinly populated. If Mothman wanted to live there, not very many people would bother him. I also discovered that during the Second World War, when they were building this ammunition dump, they built a whole network of tunnels in which to transport the high explosives from the arsenal to the various igloos. No one in the whole region knew the location of these tunnels. There were no maps available. There were some entrances to some of these tunnels, but when I went into them, I found them full of water. But it's very possible that there is a network of tunnels down there that was not full of water. And I wanted to explore them more fully, but the few openings that I found, I couldn't get anywhere. Perhaps it's just as well as I didn't, because I hate to be crawling through a tunnel and meet something 7 feet tall. I'm going back down there, as I said, and look around some more. And I have some more leads now. As I thought it would, a pattern is building up now. And we may be able to get to the bottom of this one particular case and find out whether Mothman is mechanical or an angel or what he is. Here's a fan letter that I got from France, Nice, France. It says, "Dear Sir, I say the UFOnauts are ignorant, silly, and have no brains, plain fools. They have worked a long time, probably, to put together a machine that brings them from outer space or inner space in search of new worlds with life on them. And when they find one, ours, they won't stick around to see the life on it, talk with its people, examine our machines, vegetation, or try to find out whether we reproduce by sexual integration or binary fission. Binary fission doesn't sound like much fun. That letter didn't come from the most literate fellow in the world, but there's a bit of truth in what he says. Now we've had a chance to analyze over 2,000 of these creatures' sightings, and we find that the majority of the creatures sighted around grounded UFOs have behaved in a stupid and animal-like manner. They have sometimes shown hostility and attacked human beings viciously and crudely in an animal-like manner, clawing and things like that. Now, out of 2,000 contactee and contactor cases, only about 100 of the alleged witnesses, or 5% of the total, have claimed that the beings that they encountered displayed superior or even normal intelligence. In the other 1,900 cases, the witnesses claimed that the creatures behaved in a clumsy, stupid manner, had glassy eyes, and if they spoke, they had faltering and rambling and confused speech. In short, they're pretty stupid. Now, a very famous researcher named Amy Michel, a French ufologist, recently wrote an article about the problem of contact, and he said this, quote, "Perhaps the beings who are really responsible for the UFO phenomenon are never there, and nobody has seen them ever. All that we see are robots. These robots are made for a certain task, just as we have produced milk cows, watchdogs, racehorses, and so on. The task for which they are destined would not comprise contact with us." As you know, in the majority of cases, where the witnesses stumble on the creatures accidentally and the creatures quickly flee. They jump into their machines and take off. There seems to be a great deal of validity for this argument. We'd all like to believe that there's a superior intelligence behind these things, but so far, they haven't shown much intelligence at all. Certainly in their pursuit of automobiles, that's remarkably stupid, and it goes on all the time. A few weeks ago, we had two women out in Long Island who were scared to death when a flying saucer came in from the Atlantic and chased their automobile for about 10 miles. These automobile chases go on all the time. I haven't yet reached the point in my statistical survey where I've been able to sum up how many of them there were in 1966, but there were a lot of them. And usually when they chase an automobile, when the automobile reaches an area where there are bright lights, brightly lighted street or street signs or what have you, the object will then leave. It won't continue to follow them into a lighted area. Or if the thing has been chasing them along lonely roads, as soon as the traffic picks up, the object will lead them along. We could speculate that perhaps the objects were trying actually to catch these automobiles and to catch the people in them, because we now have quite a few cases where this has apparently happened. You're all familiar with the Barney Hill case, Barney and Betty Hill. You're probably not aware that there are several other cases identical to it. I think I discussed them very briefly in Long John last night. It's very late, and I only had a chance to cover about 10% of what I was going to discuss tonight.